Welcome to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios and the EAA Chapter 84 podcast. I'm your host, David Weber. We are back from our Oshkosh break with an exciting new episode featuring the man who has been a constant contributor to the chapter for many years and is in his final year as chapter president, Jim McGoy. Jim takes us down his storied past and tells us how a scuba diving addiction can lead to an aviation addiction. Jim has numerous aviation stories he shares with our listeners, including a few that challenged his pilot skills and decisions. One of these stories became very personal as it demonstrated just how much safer aviation has become with the introduction into the cockpit of electronic equipment like the Dynon Skyview. Jim wraps up the interview with thoughts on the future of aviation for our youth, electric flight, and organizations like the EAA. Jim brings many years of EA Chapter 84 experience with him into the interview, and it was surely a walk down memory lane for both of us. The podcast wraps up as I bring you the latest Chapter 84 news, some interesting events happening in the aviation world, and finally, my thoughts on Oshkosh 2021. We'll be right back after a quick break. Well, welcome to the Flabby Bottom Flying Club Studios. I am honored this podcast to bring you current EA Chapter President Jim McGoy, and he's joining us here. Welcome to the chapter, and welcome to the studios here, Jim.
Well, thank you, David.
So let's kind of jump right into this whole mess of a life you have. let's start with the youth. Where did you end up growing up?
I was born in Poughkeepsie, New York, at Vassar Hospital across the river from West Point. My mother made a note of making sure I knew that. And I had my first birthday in the middle of the Atlantic Ocean going to Germany. My mother was English. My father was in London in World War II, and he didn't have to go on the mainland and fight because he could type. And not very many men could type back then in World War II. So he had the security clearance and the rank that he could type orders that were secret.
And interesting.
So he stayed there, and of course they were looking for dates and everything else, and he met my mother, and he came back to the U.S., mustered out, went back there. They married, and a year and a half later, you know, well, anyway, even before that, there were thousands of war brides waiting to come to the United States, and they weren't getting a ticket, and after 6 months pregnancy, they wouldn't give anyone a ticket because they didn't want anybody to have the child on the boats. They didn't have the facilities.
Understood.
So my mother wrote to the U.S. Embassy and said, I must have a ticket because my son must be born on American soil so that he has the opportunity to be president of the United States.
That's incredible.
She got a ticket by return mail. I was born
Sounds
in
like
New York.
Sounds like a smart lady.
She says, sorry, son. She's told me the story. She says, I wasn't really worried about you. I just wanted to get back to your father.
That's wonderful.
So I was born in New York, and my first 9 of my first 14 years were spent in Europe. I spent 6 years in Germany and 3 years in France, and in between those two, I was in New Jersey and New York. My father stayed in the Army. And
so you were a military brat.
So I was a military brat. He was a sergeant, and usually the tour was 3 years, mm-hmm. and he went to Germany, but it was so cheap there that he signed up for a second 3-year tour. So he was there for 6 years. And even on a sergeant's pay, they had a full-time maid.
That's great.
You know, and my mother didn't work, and they were in this apartment. And the deal was the U.S. rebuilt a lot of these apartments, put the GIs in them and with their families, with the idea that after 20 years, the Germans would get them back. And that was part of the reconstruction phase for Germany. So, and being British, we would go back and visit grandparents in England. They would come over. And so that's basically how I grew up. And then finally, my father was shipped to California before Fort Ord was shut down. And that's where I, that's where he mustered out. And that's where I basically remember.
What about, what year was this about?
This was 1959. We came here.
Now you had a brother or sister at this point?
My sister is 5 years younger than I am.
Okay.
And, you know, we got along fine. And so, you know, but none of us, neither one of us was interested in aviation at that time. It wasn't a hobby. I mean, I built plastic models. I never built a balsa wood or a U-line or anything like this. It wasn't part of my, you know, just wasn't there.
So what did young Jim find interesting at this point? What were your hobbies at this time?
You know, not that much, really. At 18, I started scuba diving. And basically, some friends said, hey, Jim, you want to dive? Okay. I mean,
and that was that.
There was no training. Today, you can't get an air fill or anything else without a certification. But they reminded me, always breathe. That's it. That was the only rule they told me. Because if you hold your breath and come up from the surface, your lungs are going to expand with the expanding air. And that's it. You can get into.
So now, where did you end up graduating from high school?
I graduated from high school, North Salinas High School. And it was an interesting story there. I was kind of a regular guy shooting hoops during lunchtime and everything else. And my girlfriend at the time was treasurer. And she'd already been elected in her junior year as assistant treasurer. And that was automatic to move up to treasurer. She didn't have to run for that. So she looked at me and said, why don't you run for something? I'd never run for office or anything like that. And she says, you ought to run for student body president. I'm going, what? You know, I mean, and so she talked me into it, and we had a gaggle of friends, and we'd go in the garage and make up posters, and I'd talk to people. And I was running up against like one of the football players who is much more popular and everything else.
Now, was this your senior year?
That was my, well, it was my junior year for the election.
Okay. And then the following year.
Then the senior year.
It was for the,
So what I did when I was running was focused on the freshmen and sophomores. Because they didn't know any of the seniors. They didn't know these jocks. They didn't know anybody on the football team. And lo and behold, I got elected. So, and that election, I got a scholarship my senior year, full ride scholarship, academic scholarship to any university in California, public or private. So just for the heck of it, I applied to Stanford. Lo and behold, I got in.
Wow.
Mainly because, you know, as student body president, I was one out of 1,500.
Right.
When I got to Stanford, one out of three was a student body president.
Wow.
I talked to my friends.
I wouldn't imagine that program is still going today. Where
I have no idea, but they look for leadership.
Yeah.
They look for not, they don't, a certain percentage, like less than 25% is academics. Mm-hmm. And they keep track of each high school. Like our high school had never graduated anybody with a 4-point. So they knew our high school was kind of tough. So 3.5 may be equivalent to a 4-point.
Right.
So they kept track of that stuff. And I talked to my friends who went to Berkeley. Berkeley, okay.
No pun intended.
And this is in '60s. I graduated in '64. And they talked and they said, you know, we sat down at our freshman orientation and they said, look to your left and look to your right. Two out of the three won't be here in a year.
Right.
That's the rate. I said, I sat down at that same type of freshman orientation, and they said 95% of you will graduate in 4 years with a Stanford degree. So basically, if you got in, They knew you could do the work.
And what did you end up graduating? What degree?
Economics.
Oh, wow.
You know, I was okay in math, mm-hmm. and I was okay at writing, and economics is the great combination of math and bull.
Right.
If you can't support it with mathematics and statistics, throw in some bulls.
But now, today, you're not even anywhere near an economics type.
Well, you know, we do quite a bit. Today, I'm a real estate appraiser.
Right.
And I have to study the market. I have to talk about inflation. I have to talk about how prices have gone up. And it's funny because I've had other careers where my background never did apply, you know, economics degree, but I find it actually applies quite a bit now. And especially when I'm talking to other appraisers, they are very interested in this.
So you get out of Stanford.
Out of Stanford. Well, I first went into Air Force ROTC.
Okay.
So this is in the 60s. I graduated in 68, and people were protesting, remember?
I was going to say.
And this all of these things, and here I was marching in ROTC. So I've been a little bit of a rebel, you know, don't go with the crowd. And that's where I got a one-hour flight in a T-33, because there were people going to Stanford who were officers going after their advanced degrees, masters and PhDs. And at that time, they don't have to today, but at that time, they had to maintain flying so many hours to get their flight pay. And so they preferred to fly with us cadets because then they logged the whole hour. If they flew with someone else, they could only log half an hour.
Oh, I got you.
So they kind of liked flying with us, even though they could give us the
stick. Put a dummy
stick
in the seat over there.
That's
so
right.
I didn't get to log at all.
I mean, I remember we had to go through a one-hour orientation, and most of that was on the ejection seat, you know. And coming out, the guy says, the guy that was my pilot, he says, you know, I'm supposed to be the last one out of the plane. He says, but things happen real fast. He says, I don't expect anything to go wrong, but if it does, it happens so fast. He says, if I ever say eject,
don't question.
If you say what, you're talking to yourself. And so I went, okay. I said, you know, my house is 75 miles away. Can we fly over there and say hi to my mom and dad from the air?
Yeah.
And he says, let's see here. We're going 500 miles an hour, and we have the plane for an hour. I think we can do that. So we did that, and it was funny because when I first touched the stick, he says, take the stick. And I touched it, and I was kind of nervous. And my hand shook a little bit, and the whole plane shook.
Oh,
I mean, it was that sensitive.
That sensitive.
You know. And so when we got over my parents' house, and, of course, I was IFR. I was flying Rhodes to get down there because it's a whole new perspective for me. They were in the backyard waving, and he says, okay, put her over on its side. And I started to pull the thing, and he went, no, and just slammed that stick to the left. And that thing went 90 degrees real fast, and we pulled a G-turn and went right over it.
Your eyeball probably went like this.
Oh, yeah. Plus, I got pushed in the seat pretty bad. Yeah. And then he says, how's your stomach? I said, fine. He says, let's go over San Francisco Bay and do some aerobatics. And that's what we did. And we hit 6 G's. So, and there was a little red line on the G meter that said 6.25. I said, what happens there? He says, theoretically, the plane falls apart. He says, we're usually flying at the edge of the envelope. I said, okay. And then another time, I was on the drill team, our Air Force drill team. And we would go to competition. So I went to a competition in a DC-3, well, C-47, And we went to Disneyland, and we did our competition. And after the competition, the guy says, we've got to go up to get our flight time. He says, does anybody want to go with us instead of going to Disney? Well, I'd already been to Disneyland 3 or 4 times. So me and 3 other guys waved our hands. We flew for 3 hours. Each one of us got 1 hour in the left seat. And all we did was go over San Diego, and we were on bikini patrol. We would just look in the backyards and say, bikini at 10 o'clock. And the person in the seat would make that plane go over. And, I mean, that thing was so sluggish. It was like you turn the wheel and 1,000, 2,000. Yeah. Finally, it would grow.
Not anything like the 33,
move.
Right?
No. So anyway, that was about it. And I forgot about aviation. The fact is that at that time, my eyes were 2400. Okay. And the Air Force was looking for pilots. So they were going, I don't know if we're going to have a place for you. And I mean, this is stupid. I'd already been in ROTC for 2 years. And I knew the Navy was 4 years. What I didn't realize that if I had stayed with the Air Force, that was a 3-year commitment. And the Army was only 2 years. Well, if I get drafted, it's 2 years. Might as well spend it as an officer.
Right.
So I went over to the Army. I said, would you take my 2 years of Air Force ROTC? Oh, sure. Come on. So I went over to the Army and finished and graduated in June of 1968. I graduated from Stanford. I got commissioned as an officer, and I got married.
All in one year.
All in 1 month within 2 weeks.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. This is in Salinas, California.
Okay.
And I went to work at Sears. They hired me as a management trainee, and I started on the dock unloading, and I followed the merchandise, and I went through credit, and I went
Wait a second. Back up here. You graduated from Stanford with a degree in economics.
Right.
And you're working at Sears.
I worked at Sears, yes. I had worked at Sears since I was 16. 16 years old.
That was the missing link. Okay.
Right. I was wearing a coat and tie in the men's
department. So you had experience at Sears.
Yeah. And they liked me. Yeah, they liked me a lot.
They said, come on board.
They said, I was hired by the vice president of the Pacific Coast directly as a upper echelon management trainee.
Okay.
And so I got into Sears. And you could delay active duty for 1 year when you got commissioned. So I knew I was married. I knew I wanted to delay it.
Okay.
So I took that 1 year and started a career. That way I'd have a job to come back to. And then I spent another year after I went on active duty going all around the U.S. getting trained as a Signal Corps officer, which was considered a combat arm. So you had three choices, and one of them had to be a combat arm. You know, I would rather have been chairborne finance.
Right,
you
know? Right.
With my background and everything. But no, they gave me the combat
arm. So now how long were you at Sears?
I was at Sears. Well, I was there for the year.
Okay.
And then went into active duty. Did training for a year, Fort Sill, Oklahoma, Fort Gordon, Georgia, places like that. And then I went to Vietnam for a year.
Okay.
So when I got out of Vietnam, I came back.
And what were you doing in Vietnam?
I was in the 51st state. At least I was, you know, we only had 50 at the time.
Right.
You know, and I was convinced Cameron Bay was going to be the 51st state. We had dial telephone. We had the ice cream truck ding, ding, ding every afternoon. We had
the bit of America base
and everything else. Oh, yeah. The only difference was there were no flush toilets. Hmm. So every morning, Papa San would come out, put diesel on the crapper, pull out the half 55-gallon drum, set it on a fire, and that's how they disposed of the crap. But the smell was not very good.
Yeah.
So, and then after 6 months, they moved me to a isolated signal site in the Central Highlands. And we had a tropospheric scatter that sent 24 channels of communications from our site to Turkey, bouncing the signal off the troposphere.
Right.
And we had tactical stuff supporting the guys in the field where we would shoot microwave from mountain to mountain. And
so basically a communications officer type thing.
Right, exactly. However, I did very little of that because the work was done by the enlisted men. And I had really good sergeants. So most of my time was spent in the other officer duties. Mess officer. Pay officer.
Wow.
You know, you had all these. I had 5 or 6. And of course, every month I had to go by and pay in script. Because it wasn't greenbacks or anything else. So our area covered several signal sites. So I'd be in a helicopter and a Jeep and everything else, you know.
And still at this point, no big interest in aviation.
No.
Just kind of.
Just doing my thing. Yeah. Whatever I was told, went where I went. So anyway, I got out, got back in Sears. And I just, after about 2 years, I realized I was too much of a rebel. You have to brown nose to go up in Sears.
Right.
And I just
didn't fit your taste.
It didn't fit me. So by this time, I had gone up in the ranks of scuba diving, and that was still my hobby on my days off. And so I talked to a guy, and he says, the manager of the store is quitting. He says, do you want to do that? So I wrote an 18-page letter, sent it to the chairman of the board, the vice president of the Pacific Coast, and everything else. And so, and then
that made all of them very happy.
Right? Oh, yeah. Well, you know, when I sold my stock at $75 a share, that was the highest Sears has ever been. Of course, now they're defunct. Right. Had I been there, well, anyway.
Had I known then, what
and
I know
so,
now.
So I moved to the dive shop, and I had a friend.
So where was this at now?
This is in, the dive shop is in Monterey, California.
Okay.
Which is about 30 miles from Salinas, which is where I was living.
And approximately what year?
1972 or okay. 3, something
so
like
early
that.
70s.
Yeah, early 70s.
So Vietnam was still going at this time.
Oh, yeah. I was 69, 70 in Vietnam. Yeah. It was pretty hot and heavy.
Yeah.
It was interesting because we would, if we were in a convoy, we'd go 60, 70 miles an hour.
So
down these old roads. So when they ambushed us, they'd only get 2 shots and we'd be gone.
I'd be gone.
Yeah, we had a few.
So it's early 70s, and you're doing a dive shop now.
Now I'm moving to a new career as a dive shop. And I had a friend who worked for me at Sears, and he followed me. He quit Sears, followed me to work at a dive shop, became an instructor. And so we're both instructing and teaching diving. And then he got a great job as a fireman in California.
So how long was he with you?
He was with me about a year.
Okay.
Okay. And as a fireman, it's a great job, mm-hmm. you know, great pay, great benefits and everything else. And then not that many people, especially anybody younger than about 50, doesn't remember Prop 13 in California, right. where they capped property taxes at 1%, which meant a reduction, and 30% of all firemen and policemen lost their job all over California.
Right.
It was a major riff. And so Wesley lost his job. And he came to me and I said, Wes, I can't hire you. I've already hired a replacement instructor. And he says, well, I guess the only way I'm making money now is when I fly. And I went, you're a pilot? I mean, I'd known him for years. I didn't know he was a pilot.
And he had never even...
Never mentioned, just never came up, you know. Yeah. Our girlfriends were good friends together, you know.
But he's
got to
be a CFI, so that's... I mean, who wouldn't talk about...
I don't know.
The check rides and all the
right.
requirements that you have to do?
Yeah. Never mentioned it.
Wow.
So anyway, I told him, oh, you know something, Wesley? The dive shop's doing well. I've got some time. Why don't you teach me to fly? And I was really doing him a favor so he could get paid.
Right.
And so that was 1981, November, December, I started in Salinas, California. And
that's the airport was Salinas?
That was the Salinas. It's a towered airport, still is. And we learned in archers and warriors, low wing pipers,
right.
and tomahawks, of course, that being the cheapest one to rent. And then in about January, February of 82, I took my check ride in Monterey. And interesting on that, I knew I'd passed.
Mm-hmm.
Everything went perfect. I felt really good about it. I'm coming in to land Monterey, clearance to land. Monterey's got a tower. It's got scheduled flights and everything. And this one cloud is coming right down the center line. The only cloud in the entire sky.
And you've got the examiner in the plane.
And I've got the examiner right beside me. And I go, oh, crap. I'm going to bust minimums. Does it matter that I'm under positive control from the tower? I don't know.
Right.
You know? So I said, tower, I can't maintain clearance from the cloud. I'm going around. And you could hear the guy. Rrr, rrr, rrr. Okay.
The guy in the tower.
Yeah, guy in the tower. And the examiner didn't say anything.
He just stoic.
And I was, and so I made my go around. By the time I came around, mm-hmm. the cloud was gone. I landed just fine. And I went, did I just blow it? You know?
Oh my gosh.
And everything. And so he just came to me and says, congratulations. I'll fly with you anytime. And I said, what was right? He says, I don't know what was right. He says, no. But what you did was take charge of the situation.
Right.
And that's what
pilot in command
for.
Right there.
That's right.
Yep. Make a decision, stick with it, and go for it.
Right. So anyway, I continued to rent for a while. And knowing Wesley was my friend, it's like the first time I had to go to San Diego, you go right over L.A. Well,
which is busy.
The LAX corridor is huge, but they have a VFR corridor. Oh. And just the thought of that scared the crap out of me.
Well, yeah.
You know?
That's not unusual.
And so I called Wes and I said, Wes, what you doing tomorrow? Would you go with me through the VFR corridor to San Diego? And he says, sure. You know? So we went down there and it was nothing. You know, you don't even talk to a controller. You're just in the blind. This is me going southbound. And
just
from the middle of the runway to the ocean is southbound on the right. And from the middle of the runway to the freeway is northbound.
Now you're not talking to tower?
You're not talking to tower. You don't have to get clearance. You don't have to do anything. I don't even think we had flight following or anything back then, you know?
Wow.
And of course,
this is still true today.
This is with a microphone. I think I had just basically got my first David Clark headset at that time. So we went down there and came back and I went, boy, you know, it was intimidating. But once you got in it, it was nothing. And so one day Wesley calls me up and he says, Jim, he says, you want your complex endorsement? And I said, what? He says, one of our renters got stuck by weather in the Arrow. Retractable gear, adjustable prop. And he says, do you want to go down there? He says, it's free because this guy has to pay me anyway.
Right.
And I checked with my boss. He says, I can take you. You can fly back. It's about a 5-hour flight. You'll get your complex. It will put you under the hood for an hour or so. He says, you can do all this. Throw me in that briar patch. So
you bet.
I got my complex endorsement. And along the way, I flew probably the nicest and biggest airplane I ever flew was the Saratoga, Piper Saratoga.
Right.
Sixth place. Beautiful interior, you know, 300 horses, really, really nice. But even at that time, you know, that was $150 an hour or something like that in the 80s. And then I got into a partnership with a lawyer on a Grumman Tiger.
Okay.
And we got that, and it was actually a repo from a bank.
And this is still down in California?
This is in Monterey.
Okay.
Yep. And we decided to move the plane to Carmel Valley. Even though it's a valley, it's up in the hills because it was almost always above the fog line.
Oh.
And remember what Mark Twain said. The coldest winter I ever spent was a summer in San Francisco.
Right.
You know? And that's what you have. In the middle of July, you'll have cold and a fog line in Monterey and the whole Monterey Bay area. And so by being in Carmel Valley, even though it's called a valley, it was up above the fog line. So we could drive to that, but it was like a 1,600-foot dirt strip. And I learned how to make a longer runway.
Explain
this. You make
this.
Runways longer by coming in slower.
Oh, yeah. That would make sense.
You're on the numbers or even a little bit below,
right.
And you really get that feeling for when she's about to stall. But all of a sudden, the short runway is no problem at all.
So landing at Harvey here has no impact
on
anything.
No,
no. You'd be surprised how many people are intimidated by coming into Harvey.
Oh, I bet.
Yeah.
Sure, 2,600. I mean, you know.
With obstacle on the end.
Yeah.
Displaced threshold and all that fun stuff. So
we'll get to an interesting story I have about that, about the obstacles at the
end. So you're flying the Tiger around. How long you end up flying the Tiger?
We flew it for about near a year. And then my partner, it was a high time engine and it was repossession. So my partner, being a lawyer, was a good friend of the banker. And he says, we'll make the payments.
Okay.
That'll keep it off your bad loan list. But it's not worth what the loan is, the balance on it, because it needs a new engine. He says, so we'll fly it. And no matter how long we fly it, he says, at any time we have the option to buy it if we want, or at any time we can just give it to you. Because if you got it back today, you'd have a high time. You got to put an engine in it to sell it. Mm-hmm. That makes you even more in arrears. He says, so we'll fly it for as long as we can and then make a decision. Now, this was about 1,800 hours on a 2,000 TBO engine for the Grumman Tiger. Mm-hmm. And I loved that airplane. You know, it was fast. It was neat. The nice thing was the canopy slid backwards.
Right.
And you could keep it open 2 or 3 inches in flight.
Right.
So it was, you know, on a hot day, you didn't open side doors. You just slid the canopy back and all the heat went out and you were comfortable.
Yeah.
And so anyway, he was flying, my partner was flying VFR on top of a fog bank over San Francisco. And just as he got past San Francisco, the engine
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah. So he could see Napa Airport, and he called in for an emergency. He still had about 30% power. It wasn't totally out.
Okay.
And he made it in, but because he had no chance for a go-round, it scared him pretty bad.
I can imagine.
And he landed, and he called up the banker and said, your airplane needs an engine. And it's at Napa. The thing that upset me was both of my headsets were in the airplane and he didn't bother to bring them back.
Oh my God.
So I had to rent a plane, go to Napa, get my headsets out. And, you know, then we gave the keys to the bank and everything. And I never heard anything more about it. And then I sold the dive shop and started importing printing equipment. I mean, when I did that, I made more in 3 months than my best year in the dive shop. And that fell through because the exchange rates changed. And I mean, these were great big. They were some of the pieces of equipment were as big as this room.
And what year was this that you started doing that?
This is 85, okay. 80, yeah, because we came up here in 86. So it was 84, 85. And I totally changed businesses. I was making a great living importing printing equipment, heavy equipment, but I was dealing with exchange rates. I was buying them from England. I was buying them in pounds and selling them here in dollars. And the exchange rates, my last two deals, I lost $15,000 each.
Wow.
Out of my savings because the exchange rates had changed. And I said, I can't do this. I can't even make it up in volume, you know. So my wife says, what are we going to do? I said, we're going to take a vacation. 86 was the year Expo was in British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went up to see Expo, and we were tent camping. We had a van, and we had 3 tents, the 2 kids, my wife and myself. We had the goldfish. We had the golden retriever and the blind cat. And so we were camping all over, and my wife says, what are you going to do? And I said, oh, you know, I've always wanted to get into real estate. Maybe I'll do that up here. And she says, well, where? And I said, well, I want a diversified economy. I don't want lumber and agriculture. I don't want forestry. So that meant Eastern Washington was out. Most of Oregon was out. And it was really from Tacoma to Everett.
Right.
That was the area. And so we looked around Tacoma, and then we moved up a little bit. And my wife saw a sign, and she said, could we live in Marysville? My wife's name is Mary.
There you go.
Why not?
Yeah. Yeah, it was a sign.
Yeah. So we found a place, and we've been in and around Marysville ever since. And
so now are you still doing aviation?
I'm doing a little bit, but not very much because I had to watch my shekels.
Right.
So anyway, I really wanted to. I was out for about 3 years.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, you know, I've got too much invested.
Right.
In my ticket and everything else. And fortunately, my wife said, yeah, I agree. So I started renting again.
And where was this out of that you were renting?
Arlington.
Okay.
Yeah, because I'm living in Marysville.
Right.
And so I started renting in Arlington. And then a friend of mine who was an A&P lived right across the street. He says, Jim, you want to buy into a 172?
Twist my arm.
Sure.
Yeah.
1959, straight down. And yep. So I did, and I flew that for 18 yeah. years. And
I remember that plane.
Yeah, I flew a lot of Young Eagles in it and everything else. Got back into I had joined EAA in about 1982, 83. Got my ticket early 82, joined EAA and AOPA. And I bought a set of plans for a long easy direct from Burt Rutan.
Gotcha.
Never started it. I knew I wasn't craftsman enough. Mm-hmm. I knew I didn't have the patience and the time from the dive shop and everything. So I had these plans. I bought a set of plans and a friend of mine bought a set of plans. He started his long easy. And then about halfway through the build, he was in a plane at nighttime and things didn't come out well for him. And so he... You know, his son inherited the Long Easy project.
The Long Easy's got a very narrow mission profile.
It does. And he wasn't in that because he was halfway through his build. He was in, I think, a Bonanza, and he stalled it on takeoff at night. Yeah. Just pulled back too much and stalled it.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah. So anyway, you know, coming back here, I had the 172, but it had always been a dream. Two things on my bucket list. Build an airplane and fly into Oshkosh.
There you go.
And they didn't have to be the same plane. I just wanted to fly into Oshkosh.
Right.
So in 2014, EAA had the one-week wonder. And I had been waiting for, well, actually, let's back up a little bit to about 2012 or 13. I had been waiting for a chapter at Arlington Airport.
Right.
I expected it because of all the RVs and home builds and everything else.
There's a lot of home build activity up there.
Yes, and there never was. So I belonged to the National, but I didn't belong to a chapter. And I just felt out. I mean, everything I'd ever done, two or three scuba diving clubs, I had been on the board, I had been president of all of them.
Right.
You know, it was just in my blood to do this. So I finally came here to Harvey Field and joined the chapter.
When you joined Chapter 84, it was here at Harvey Field at that point.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And so what year was that?
2013, somewhere around there.
Okay.
And I really wanted to belong. I wanted to get, you know, some information on home building. And I have always been one to support the sport that I'm in.
Right.
So when I was scuba diving, I was on the board or president and everything else.
Yep.
When I was flying AOPA, EAA, and I wanted to have a local chapter and I wanted to help the chapter. So I kind of volunteered pretty quick to be on the board.
Mm-hmm.
What did I do? Newsletter or something like that?
Right.
You know, right off the bat.
That was your first thing.
Yeah.
Right?
And so, you know, I joined. And in 2014, EAA at Oshkosh had the 1 week wonder. And then in February 2015, in Sport Aviation, they declared they were going to give five sets of wings to five chapters.
Right.
Because rather than a one-week wonder, they wanted to get more chapters involved in building at Oshkosh. So I sent them an email. I didn't even ask the board. It was kind of not real cool. But I sent and said, pick me, pick me, pick me.
Right.
We want a set of wings for our chapter. And then I went to the board and I said, this is it. And I said, I'll form a flying club. There will be no financial obligation or anything.
Because rules say that chapters cannot have...
Well, they can build,
yeah,
but they can't own or operate.
Right.
So, and I can't financially obligate the chapter for building an airplane. I mean, okay, you get the set of wings, which is $6,000 out of about 70, you know. So,
but it's a start.
I communicate
better than nothing.
Well, it's a kick in the tail to get started.
Right.
You know, so anyway, I,
and this
I
was
communicated.
Five separate wings that they gave?
They gave, yeah. Sonics gave a set of wings. Rands was going to give a set of wings. Vans gave a set of wings and two from Zenith.
And out of those five, how many finished?
Well, Rands dropped out. Oh. Rands.
Never completed their...
They didn't even... So Zenith provided three sets of wings.
Oh, they stepped up.
Two 750s and a 650.
Okay.
And so I had been communicating with Charlie Becker. Yep. Mm-hmm. Charlie Becker at EAA. And I said, pick me. He says, you got to have a hangar. We got a hangar. Mm-hmm. You got to form a flying club for after it's built. How form a flying club?
Right.
So I did all these. And in fact, we got what I wanted, which was a low wing.
The 650.
The 650.
Right.
And so this was...
They were already built there on the field at Oshkosh.
Right. I mean, we got nothing but the kit. Okay, which is the built spar, and then we had to build the wings.
Oh, I thought that the wings were built during Oshkosh.
No, we built them at Oshkosh.
Right, right.
So I told my wife in 2015, I says, I have to go to Oshkosh.
Right, right.
You know,
so this was rather than the 1 week wonder, they were building all of the wings.
Correct.
That would go to the chapters.
Correct.
Okay.
So I've got a video of doing this and opening the crate and everything else on YouTube. And so we built wings and, you know, I finally got one day that I got to see Oshkosh. That was Saturday. I said, guys, I've been here almost a week and all I've done is build wings all day. And, of course, you know, then... After the air show, everything quits. And in fact, almost when the air show starts, everybody goes and watches it and everything. Mm-hmm. So anyway, I formed a flying club. There were five members in it. It whittled down to four. One of them lost his job, Gordon.
Yeah.
But he helped build. There were five of us. And he was unemployed, so he spent a lot of time. And Roger Venables. Helped build because I couldn't understand exactly why Roger, because he had already built a 750.
Right.
You know, he had an airplane. But anyway.
Better to do,
That was, you know, so without those two guys working on it so much time, we never would have done it. Because one of the rules was build it from 2015 and fly the completed plane back to Oshkosh in 2017. Well, 2017 came along, and we finished the build the end of April, got our airworthiness certificate, but then we have 40 hours. 40 hours is, I mean, for a lot of people, that's half a year of flying.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're flying on the weekends and stuff like that. And so the middle of July, on a Sunday, I flew off the 40th hour. Wednesday, I took off for Oshkosh.
You'd be surprised how many have done that exact
same
thing.
And out of the five,
right,
only two of us, a 750 and our 650, made it to Oshkosh. So, you know, Oshkosh always has a thunderstorm.
Right.
It's obligatory.
Right.
Okay.
Happened this year.
I didn't have to worry about it because our 650 was inside the home-built barn.
Oh.
It was on display.
Everybody else is out there tying down. And,
right. Yeah. I did have my tent in the home-built area, but it was in a separate section right next to the pavilion or whatever they call it. Not next to my airplane because my airplane was on display.
There you go. Know?
So, yeah, it was kind of cool.
So what year did you end up becoming president of EA Chapter 84? Do you remember what year that was?
Well, it would have been 4 years ago, so it would have been 2017, somewhere like that.
Okay.
Because this is my fourth year, and we have
pretty much the same year that you flew the plane back.
Right, right. Yeah. And I'd been on the board
since
I started, 2013 and stuff. So
you've always been an active member from the day that I can remember you coming on board.
Right. And that's kind of, that's me. I just,
If it came from burger burns to flyouts, Jim was there, so.
Yeah. Especially Young Eagle flights.
Right.
Yeah.
Young Eagles flights.
Young Eagles was a big thing of mine even when I had the 172. So.
You must be up there in numbers, and you've got to be.
I got about 270. Wow. 270. Flights.
It's probably the highest in the chapter, I would imagine.
It used to be. I know when it was 260, it was somebody else had 250, but they weren't active anymore.
Okay.
So I don't remember who that was, but they they aren't even in the chapter or coming to meetings anymore. So
now you're on the sunset side of your presidency.
Yes, definitely.
Because
we got to find a replacement between now and December.
What a lot of members don't realize is that we put term limits on the president.
Only on the president. It's the only office.
And the reason for that was that we didn't want to have somebody stuck, quote unquote, in that position so that more people would step up and become president, knowing that there was a term limit on that.
Yes.
And so that makes it a little more palatable to people to step into that position.
Yeah, and I think we did pretty good. When I started, we had about 40 members, and now we're over 70.
Right.
When I started, we had about $3,500 in the bank, and now we're over 12 grand. So I think, you know, all in all, I mean, there's stuff.
No, successful.
Yeah, especially with the pandemic. I mean, we pulled in 20 members or so during the pandemic. I mean, that surprised me.
And I think a lot of that is due to the social media effort that you put into it, all that kind of reach, the outreach programs.
I've expanded the board.
Right.
You know, we had like 6 members or something. Now we've got 10 or 11 on the board. And I like to get other people to volunteer because a little bit for each one person doesn't make it a lot for anyone.
Right.
And like Ashitha, 14 years old, is on the board
as our
youth ambassador.
Right.
You know, and so we've definitely added to the board as people have volunteered.
Do you think that's part of the key of your success as president, is that approach?
I had never thought of it. And I don't know if I'm saying it was a success as president or not. It was simply, this is how I operated. This is what I did. Mm-hmm. This is what I think. Every time I could see a job, I'd try to get a new volunteer rather than foist it upon an existing board member. Like when we started Zoom.
Right.
Okay. When it was just me, it was one thing. But now when we've started having in-person meetings, we needed someone to do the electronics for the Zoom meeting. And I'm running the meeting.
Right. And so for those of you that are listening to this podcast, in 2050, Zoom was an internet meeting application because we're in the middle of a pandemic. We couldn't meet in our typical hangar here on Harvey Field. So we had to do everything virtually through the internet. And that required resources.
Right. And so when we started in-person meetings, we had to have both the in-person and the Zoom. And Ben Sinclair stepped up.
Right.
And, you know, we made him our person. We needed a website person. Ian stepped up for that. Right. I mean, we've had some really good people step up. We needed a secretary. And Philip has stepped up as secretary, and he's done a great job.
Yeah. And he set up the OneDrive and all. I mean, it's been great.
Yeah. And he's also helped with IT. He's very knowledgeable on that. You know, one of the hardest jobs of being president was programs. We had some great programs. We had your Ranger, you know, actually the world premiere showing of it here for our chapter. We've had the CEO of Zoomix, the electric engine manufacturer, here. But it's really that's one of the hardest jobs as president. It was. So I looked all over, and Jonathan Fay stepped up and said, "I'll do programs," and he's done a great job.
Yeah, as long as we just keep. Everybody feeds that, and he coordinates it and makes it a lot easier.
Oh, yes. Yeah. And we've had suggestions from other members, but it's really key to have that one person that actually makes it happen.
Takes it and coordinates it.
Right.
Yeah, because I know from experience.
Well, you had great programs, too.
That's the biggest chore is keeping that content coming because that's what members want. They want that content coming for the different programs stuff that relates to them that they can only get through the chapter. And then you get that group feeling. Come on, let's admit it. That feeling of I belong to something and that they do special things.
Right. Yeah. And so we've got a very large board right now. They've been very active and they've done such a great job that the president's job now is actually pretty easy.
Yeah.
And it's been very instrumental. So anyway, I flew in 2017. I flew my little Zenith 650 to Oshkosh. And 2018, I wanted to go, but I didn't think it was right to take the airplane for, you know, a week like that, 10 days. And so I flew commercial, and that was quite the experience. I had all my camping gear in a big checked bag, my tent, my sleeping bag, everything in a big checked bag. And being the penny pincher that I am, I could have flown to Milwaukee, but that was more money. So I flew to Chicago, and I took the train from Chicago to Milwaukee. And then in Milwaukee, I caught a Greyhound bus, and they stop right there at Whitman Field at Oshkosh.
Right, could do special. Yep.
Right. And it's on the other side of the field by the terminal, but that's okay because they had the school bus and you just grabbed that. Yeah, so that was 2018, you know, and then in 2019, I flew again and I had a very interesting mishap.
Explain to our listeners your exciting
trip. I don't go in a straight line because flying to Oshkosh, the adventure of flying there and seeing the country is as much as the destination.
Oh, I agree 100%.
Even though the destination is fantastic.
Yeah, people that get up at 15,000 feet and fly are missing a lot.
They're missing a lot. So anyway, everything was rather uneventful, except I have to tell you that having that Dynon screen is incredible flying.
I'm glad to hear that.
I would put it on the map. And the Dynon gets real-time weather downloaded. So I'm approaching, I'm still about 100, 150 miles from Oshkosh. And number one, I get a text because I had the Oshkosh app on my phone. So I get a text on my phone that says, you know, due to the storms the last 3 days, this was like Saturday, no aircraft parking on the grass.
Mm-hmm. Sloshkosh.
Excuse me. All the aircraft park on the grass at Oshkosh. So they were turning away everybody.
Right.
So I knew I'd have to go to, I went to Wisconsin Dells.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I spent the night. And then I look ahead and here's this storm line. And I look at the Dynon, and I could see the squall line.
Right.
And I could see where it ended, and I could see this. Well, it was a detour of about 10 miles, but that's about all it was. And I was out of the wind. I didn't have to worry about it. But having that weather real time on the screen right there was fantastic.
Right.
And so at Wisconsin Dells, if you ever go there, there's a couple of hotels. The airport manager can tell you that that give special deals to pilots.
Oh, great.
And so it was a $150 room, cost me $59.
There you go.
So, great, great event in 2019. I get on the plane, I fly back, and I'm getting ready to cross the Rockies, which is always the biggest pucker factor of crossing the United States. And I'm flying Rhodes. I fly I-90.
Which is a smart thing to do.
And at that point, I knew I-90 was one of the lowest passes through the north end of the Rockies.
And there's airports just on
there
each
are.
Side of I-90 going over there.
Right.
There's lots of options.
So it's clear air, minimal turbulence, no storm, nothing in the sky. And I'm flying along about a mile east of I-90, and it's going northwest at this point. And it's just about ready to go over the pass. Bam! I drop I don't know if I dropped 50 feet, 100, or 500 feet. I know it took me about 500 feet to get control of the aircraft again. But I just dropped out of the sky. Clear air turbulence. And I'm on a PAP machine. Mm-hmm. And I had a battery and a solar panel to run it. And it worked perfect during the week. But this battery is like 12 pounds. And I had blocked it in sideways. But I never thought I'd have to block it in going up. When I dropped, that battery went right through the canopy.
Oh, my God.
And I had a 14-inch line right above my head where the canopy had jagged edges and the wind was coming in. And it took my headset, boom, right out. But it didn't pull it all the way. So I was able to grab the headset cable,
pull it back,
put it on, and I immediately got on the Dynon after I got control.
Yeah, so now the plane's under control.
So now the plane's under control, but it won't go above 80 knots.
Aviate,
navigate, communicate. Right. Well, nobody could help me at that point, and I wasn't stabilized yet. So I aviated, I got control of the aircraft. Now I want to navigate to someplace pretty close, but I want someplace with services.
Right.
And a lot of those little airports don't have services.
No.
So on the Dynon, nearest, and I started scrolling through, and 32 miles away was Big Timber, Montana. Okay, so I'm about 500 AGL at this point.
Okay.
I was 1,000 AGL or more, a little more than that when this whole thing started. And I can hardly climb, and I can't do more than about 80 knots because the wind is coming in through this open gap and hitting the bulkhead behind my baggage compartment, and that acts as a drag. So it's a non-towered airport, and I approach it. I'm 5 miles away. I don't see the airport. I'm 3 miles away. I'm 2 miles away. 2 miles away, and I can't see the airport. And on the Dynon screen, it is right in front of me, 2 miles away. And oh, I see. There's this plateau that sticks up about 500 feet, and the airport's on top of it.
Oh, jeez.
I barely climbed up enough to make a final. But I just announced there were nobody else. There's nobody else there, and I made a straight in final and landed without incident and pulled over. And here was this guy in just dungarees and everything, and he says, "Oh yeah, the airport manager's out doing crop dusting right now. He should be back any minute here." He says, "I'm just waiting for my ride." 5 minutes later, his ride arrived. It was a citation. He was one of these remote investors that owned farming, you know, owned the land, but only came to visit it once in a while. And so anyway, the airport manager came, and he was wonderful. He gave me a nice big section of a big airport to work with. He gave me some tools. He helped me out. They had a car.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
yeah.
I think it was
courtesy car there.
Right. And they charged for it $5 a day. So I needed some tools. So, you know, I went into Big Timber, the little town.
Right.
And I went to they have an aviation supply store. Did you know that in Big Timber?
Really?
Yeah. It's the signs.
Everybody knows about Big Timber Aviation.
The sign says Ace Hardware, but it's really an aviation.
It's really Big Timber.
At least it was for me. So I went into town, got a place to stay, got some tools, talked to him, and set it up. And the next day I spent 14 hours, and I took out the jagged edges and got a piece of, actually, it was steel. It wasn't aluminum, but it was very thin.
Uh-huh.
And I drilled the holes and riveted that. That's what I got.
So you're able to do a canopy repair right there.
So I did a repair there. And I told him, I said, okay, you know, the next day, the next morning, I said, I'm taking off. If I don't come back, everything's good. If something's wrong, I'll just come back and land and we'll do something else. Well, the plane flew almost the same as before the repairs, before the accident. So I was able to come home across the Rockies, home across the Cascades, land without incident, and you know, immediately called for a new canopy, but that took a couple of weeks to get. So the plane was down for about a month, and we install a new canopy. And
that made for an exciting last trip to Oshkosh.
Last trip in the airplane.
Last trip in the airplane.
I did go this year, but you know, at first I was going to take the plane and camp, but then my wife says she would like to go. Well, with the camping gear and me, there's no room for anybody else. So we took the travel trailer and made a great big trip. Yeah. So that was interesting.
Well, I got to tell you, that's some pretty exciting aviation stories.
we haven't even got to the time right here at Harvey that I was flying Young Eagles. And this was while we were building. So it would have been about 2016. And at Arlington Airport, I rented the Sling, is it?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, two-place, light sport.
Right.
Had the same Rotax engine, and I was renting that so that I could get time in the same type of plane as the Zenith 650. And I had flown three flights of Young Eagles, and I was ready to return to Arlington, return the plane. I take off. I'm about 100, 150 feet. And the engine goes, ugh.
Complete quit?
No.
Oh.
Now, we're trained what to do on takeoff when the engine quits, which is land straight ahead. Set it up for best glide. Do you know what's straight ahead? The trees, the river, and then that huge electrical distribution yard.
Mm-hmm.
I ain't setting it down straight ahead, you know, and then I'm fiddling with it and I discover, wait a minute, I do have a little bit of power. I get 25-30% power, just my rough estimate. Uh-huh. Okay, so the impossible turn? Well, maybe not with no power, but how about this? So I turn and I turn a 180 and I'm ready to land with the wind on the grass. And by this time, my momentum had taken me up to about 300 feet. And there I was at best glide, 70 or so. But it wouldn't get any higher. You know, I didn't have the engine to get any higher. But I was maintaining that. So I slowly came down. And Arnold was at the end of 3-3, ready to take off with a student, and I get on the radio.
Arnold Ebnetter.
Ebnetter, yes.
Who we've interviewed here on the podcast.
Yes, and I didn't know at the time it was him.
Go listen to the podcast if you haven't yet.
And so I said, I've got an emergency engine out. I'm, you know, can you wait for me? Hold up. And he was past the stop line. He was ready to get on the runway. Absolutely. So, I mean, I didn't even make it to the fence. I turned around on the south end of Harvey Field where the fence is before the roadway, and I turned around and I was able to make a full 360 and I landed it right there. And I remember Arnold saying, good job.
Yeah, that's a compliment from him.
Oh, it sure is. So I was able to land it, and I did have, you know, enough power to taxi, so I taxied. And here at Harvey Field, the transient parking is on the grass up on the east side of the field, just east of the dihedral and the windsock and everything. And so I parked it there. And actually, I went around first and tried it. And you see, at 4,000 RPM, which is where you check the Rotax, everything was fine. But at 5,000 RPM, it quit.
Mm.
And I had not thought to pull back on the throttle.
No.
I may have, you know, gotten a little extra power. I don't know. But anyway.
Well, you're thinking, don't touch anything.
Just set it for best glide and get ready to, you know.
Right.
So anyway, I parked it, and I called up there, and the instructor was the only guy there at Arlington Flight Services, and he came down. And I'm sure he felt that he could just start it right up. And it started right up. And he duplicated what I did. I said, at 4,000, it's okay. At 5,000 and above, and of course, you're at 5,300, 5,500 when you're on takeoff power. And he duplicated that, and he looked all over, and he couldn't find anything. He says, fine. And he gave me a ride back to Arlington where my wife picked me up. And so Monday, the mechanic came down, and he looked at it. It took him 2 days. He could duplicate it, and he couldn't find out what was wrong. Fuel looked good. Everything looked good. Finally, at the end of the second day, which is a long time for a mechanic to be looking at something like this, he discovered that I think it was a little piece of rubber. I mean, this plane had been flying for 5 years, and it had finally broke free and somehow got through all the filters and was plugging one of the carburetors.
One of the jets, huh?
Yeah. And it was just when you were at full power that you felt it. And, of course, there's two carburetors. Mm-hmm. They feed, you know, two cylinders each, right, left and right side. Well, when you lose two out of four cylinders, you're not at 50% power because now the other two have to push the drag of the non-performing pistons.
Right.
So that's why I think my 25-30% was fairly accurate. And it took them 2 weeks. The plane was here at Harvey Field before they got the parts for it, got it fixed and flew it back. But yeah. Well,
you're here to tell the story.
Yeah. Engine failure on takeoff. One of the worst things that could ever happen to anybody.
Well, so let's talk a little bit about future of aviation.
Sure.
Where do you think aviation's going? Where do you see aviation in 5-10 years?
Drones, autonomous, electric. It's going to be a different world. We're going to have new airspace regulations because I think that probably not for 1 or 2 years, but 3 to 5 years, we're going to have a lot of places doing taxi rides, which will require, I'm sure, pilots at first in electric VTOLs, vertical takeoff landing, and you know, it's like going to SeaTac or something like that. That's going to be so easy instead of fighting traffic. And you're going to get a lot of people that are in downtown Seattle that if they can get the permission to go on top of some of the buildings.
So you're talking like this air taxi.
Right. I think that's going to be the future. I think, but I still think that we're always going to have pilots. We're going to have recreational pilots, and probably for the next 20 years, I could see, we're going to have commercial pilots and airliners. I think the first step is to eliminate the first officer, and they'll do that with remote, autonomous.
They've already done that in a lot of cargo.
Right. And so now I think they're going to move that into passenger, but passengers want a pilot. And it may come, but I think it's going to be.
I think it's going to be a generational thing where you know, one generation is going to grow up seeing all these autonomous vehicles flying around, and they're going to start to question why there's a pilot up front.
Especially if they can save $20 on their ticket.
Yeah, that might be part of it. I think another part of it might be they're going to think that the computer can fly the aircraft better in situations than the human can.
Right.
And I think that's probably, it's a comfort, right? It's what you know.
That's right. You know, and of course, we had no choice when we started flying.
Oh, yeah.
And even today, you know, commercial airliners are going to have to, even the little Horizon flights and stuff like that, the local flights and stuff. They've got the captain and first officer.
Yep.
And that'll be around for quite a while.
So we're talking here about future of aviation, and we touched a little bit about what the next generation is going to expect. What kind of advice would you give to next generation aviators? What would you think that somebody has an interest in an aviation career? What would you tell them?
Well, one of the things, and I just finished giving a talk. I've given two talks now to youth groups. Mm-hmm. I talked to the Red Tail Hawks.
Right.
Just a week ago, I gave a presentation there.
Red Tail Hawks, which is, explain what that group is.
Oh, they're primarily, even though they take all, and you'll find all right. people there, they focus on giving aviation opportunities to people of color.
Okay.
So they've got a lot of African-American
right.
youth that are interested.
Sort of an offshoot of the World War II Red Tails.
That's exactly right. Right. That's what they're patterned after.
Right.
But I think really, and we talk so much about the future of aviation, and we talk about pilots. But the future of aviation, they need so much more right now than pilots. They're going to need 50,000 pilots in 10 years, but they're going to need mechanics, A&Ps. Mm-hmm. They're going to need flight attendants. They're going
to
need
still have
people
to
behind the counter.
The aircraft.
Yeah. I mean, they've simplified things where now you almost always check in electronically instead of going to a person at the check-in counter when right. you fly commercial. But there's a lot of aviation jobs that are not just pilot jobs. And I think that we need to get people interested in those also. Drones are going to be huge. Autonomous is going to be huge. And yeah, there may not be a pilot in that drone, but there's an operator.
Correct.
You know, there is definitely an operator. And it may come to the point where maybe one operator for four or five drones, but you're still going to have somebody there that has to monitor everything. So I think that's the future that we're looking at, electric and autonomous and jobs across the board. And, of course, drone mechanics are going to be a big deal. They're hardly anything mm-hmm. right now. But as drones and autonomous aircraft get larger, they have to be maintained.
And one of the issues I see with mechanics, especially drones or operators, is unfortunately the liability that goes along with that. And right now, with our litigious society, you know, there's a lot of responsibility that goes. And you see pilot protection as far as commercial carriers go. But what about the people that are working on those aircraft? Where's their protection?
Right. Right.
And you see today, it's harder and harder to find that IA that will come out and do an inspection on your aircraft because the liability is so great anymore.
That's exactly right.
So overall, do you think that there's a bright future for aviation, or do you think aviation is at a decline or just sort of in a stale? What do you see?
I think it's pretty bright, but I think we really have to thank AOPA and EAA for this.
Mm-hmm.
And
I would agree.
I am really happy to see both of those organizations and NBAA, National Business Association, working together as one, mm-hmm. fighting. I mean, you know, the FAA, what, 3 or 4 years ago, the FAA was dragging its feet on new regs. So Congress passed a law and said, this is what you will do, and, you know, gave us some rights and made the FAA.
Well, look what the FAA just did with training and experimental.
Oh, it's horrible.
Right.
You know, of course, the problem with that is I don't know if it's the FAA as much as it was a court decision. The court decision said, now right. you are all basically, you know, for hire. And in aviation, not just whether you instruct or not, or something like that.
Yeah, it was based off of an FAA interpretation of it.
And so if they reword those regs, or if Congress gets into it, which I know all of EAA, AOPA, and everybody
very actively working to get that changed. Right
so
now.
Everybody knows it's wrong. It's just going to take time to get it changed. It's like everybody knows. What, 2 or 3 years, they're going to change the rules for sport aviation. But what if you want your license now?
Yeah.
You know, it's like a lot of old timers are going over to sport because their driver's license is their medical.
Yeah. Hey, Jim, I got to tell you, this has been an absolute wonderful evening here. I learned a lot about you I didn't know. And obviously, your passion comes through in your speak. And it's been an absolute pleasure to be here with you and share this time, and I hope that our listeners feel the same way. Thanks for coming down.
Well, you're welcome. I hope they find something interesting in this podcast. Thank you, David.
Thank you. And now, chapter news for September 2021. This month's meeting will be held September 14th, starting at 7 p.m. As of today, this meeting is open to anyone who wishes to attend in person, as well as those who want to attend via Zoom. If you are considering attending in person, please note Washington State again requires masks for all indoor events. The Zoom meeting link will be published in the newsletter. For the latest and most up-to-date information, visit the chapter website or any of the social media pages the chapter maintains, such as Facebook and Instagram. The chapter will once again be sponsoring Young Eagle Rides at Community Airport Day in Arlington on September 25th. We are still in need of a few more pilots. Even if you can only fly for an hour or two, please email chapter Young Eagles coordinator Rich Morrison at youngeagle@eaa84.org. The chapter also needs people to simply help during the event, so don't hesitate to email Rich even if you can't fly Young Eagles. The help will be appreciated. News in aviation. Vans Aircraft has announced the latest aircraft in their outstanding lineup. As many have speculated, it will be a high wing with a design directed at backcountry operations. Details are few, and some major decisions are still to be made, such as engine type and passenger numbers. But Vans president Ryan Johnson assured everyone the design is well along. As stated by Ryan during the announcement at Oshkosh, one of the goals in the design is to be very innovative, but not reinvent the wheel. You can be assured this chapter member will be in contact with Vans to see if we can get a preview of the progress on the aircraft sometime in the future. More information is available on Vans' website at vansaircraft.com. And if it isn't exciting enough to have one kit provider announce a new high wing design, Sonics Aircraft just announced their version of what a high wing Sonics aircraft will look like. Sonics President Mark Schaebel made the announcement on Experimental Aircraft YouTube channel on August 24th. Mark says the plane will be a two-place version and have Sonics-like features in both design and construction. The plane will have multiple engine combinations that will most definitely include the Aero-V. The Sonics team plans on having a flying prototype ready for Oshkosh 2023. There may be another Sonics build in my future. You can get more information at sonicsaircraft.com. EA headquarters continues to push the FAA for a legitimate solution to the recent interpretation involving compensation for flight training in experimental, limited, and primary category aircraft. The EA believes the extraordinary reversal of decades of policy has done great harm and added unnecessary confusion to aviation in the U.S. More concern is what this will do to the safety levels as training in aircraft becomes more difficult to receive. HQ promises to keep members updated as talks continue with the FAA over the upcoming months. News about Oshkosh 2021. There is no argument that Oshkosh 2021 was a success. Attendance was just over 600,000, which is within 5% of the record total of 2019. I believe this number would have been surpassed if it was not for one of the worst summer storms on record sweeping through the area on Wednesday evening, just missing the fly-in to the south, but devastating the town of Ripon. Many aircraft pulled up stakes and left early or just didn't bother to attempt the arrival. Many aircraft owners that could not leave the show tried to mitigate the potential of damage with additional ropes, stakes, and even in some cases bubble wrap. I'm talking from experience here. Overall, Oshkosh 2021 was a winner, and we can all rest a little easier now knowing that the EAA is now on a better financial foundation for it. That wraps it up for this month's podcast. I hope you enjoyed hearing from our outgoing chapter president, Jim McGoy. Please spread the word about the Chapter 84 podcast to your fellow aviation enthusiasts. This free podcast is available for download on most popular apps, including Spotify, Apple, and Google. Be sure to follow EAA Chapter 84 on social media apps like Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. Until next time, this has been your host, David Weber, and remember, stay off the brakes, keep moving forward.